The Bob Siegel Show on AM 1170. The Answer is sponsored by Bob Siegel.
The Bob Siegel Show is brought to you in part by Primetime Media Group and the law offices of Matthew Simone.
Recurring themes on The Bob Siegel Show can also be found on his online column, Forbidden Table Talk.
It's time now for the Bob Siegel Show, a religious open forum where all questions are welcome. And now, here's your host, Christian apologist, Bob Siegel.
And this is Bob Siegel. So, you'd like to believe in God, but if God really exists, why doesn't he just come down from heaven? Why doesn't he just come down to earth and make himself known? Why not come down in mighty power with a thunderous voice accompanied by miracles instead of making people just believe in him by faith? Well, my friend, that is just exactly what God did. In the days of Moses, he came down to Mount Sinai with trumpets, with fire, with a thunderous voice and a big black cloud of smoke, and the people were freaked out. They couldn't take it. They couldn't stand it. They said, Moses, we can't handle this. You go up to the mountain and listen to God yourself, and then you come down and you tell us what he said. So Moses did just as the people requested. He went up on the mountain and listened to God for 40 days and 40 nights. At that time, God gave him the rest of his laws, and there were some 300 commandments. You always hear about the Ten Commandments. It was not just 10. The significance of the Ten Commandments, and this is very important, the significance of the Ten Commandments is those were the first 10 and only 10 that God got through with his own voice before the people stopped him and asked Moses to go up and listen to the rest. Now get this, you got to love this. When Moses returned days later and started relaying the rest of God's law, the people says, now how do we know that Moses really talked to God? Moses, you saying your view of God is better than our view of God? We have our own concept of God, blah, 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 blah. Moses said, hey, this was your idea of having God speak through spokesmen. And before Moses died, when he gave his farewell State of the Union message that you can read about in the end of Deuteronomy chapter 18, he said, the idea of God speaking to you through a prophet, which he's going to call, spokesman, and that's what spokesman actually means, a prophet of God. That's the literal word for prophet, spokesman. This idea of a spokesman prophet, he said, is your idea. So from now on, God's going to keep sending prophets, and you better listen to them, and you better not tell them that they didn't come from God because it was your idea. Today, God is willing, once again, to speak to people without necessarily having to go through a prophet. He will speak to you, my friend. In fact, one of my listeners sent me an email recently asking how God speaks specifically. We will discuss this interesting topic later on in today's show, but first, the latest news. Well, the much-anticipated GOP debate is over. Trump did a fantastic job and clearly won the debate. At least according to a reliable source, Trump. Trump's strength, he speaks his mind. Trump's weakness, he keeps changing his mind so nobody knows his mind, and he's probably out of his mind. And should he lose the Republican nomination, he refuses to promise that he won't run as a third-party candidate. And if he runs as a third-party candidate and gets enough support, he hands the election to the Democrats. But then he was a Democrat until just a few years ago, and a liberal, pro-choice, pro-single-payer health care system, pro-Clinton, contributing money to the Clintons. Folks, get over your love affair with Donald Trump. Now, I should say, if he does get the Republican nomination somehow and runs against Hillary, will I vote for him? Yes, of course. I'd vote for Donald Trump before Hillary Clinton. I'd vote for Donald Duck before Hillary Clinton. Speaking of Hillary, her people have also weighed in on the debate. Hold on to your seats. The winner, Hillary. She wasn't even there, but she won. It's amazing. This woman just never ceases to stun all of us. Why did she win? Because of some of the Republican candidates' stance on abortion. It's going to be more of that war on women stuff. If you don't want to vote for Hillary, you're on a war against women. If you don't support abortion, you're on a war against women. You see, if anybody speaks against the real persecution of women going on in Muslim countries all over the world, where a woman can be arrested for driving a car or have her fingers cut off for seeking an education, where a woman can get stoned to death for marrying against her father's wishes, or arrested simply for speaking to a man in public, and even blamed if such a man rapes her, she gets blamed because she shouldn't have been out in public. Well, speaking against all that doesn't make you a defender of women's rights. It makes you an Islamophobe. It makes you politically incorrect. And yet, when somebody suggests that a law student like Sandra Fluke, in as much as she can apparently afford college, might also be able to afford about $9 a month for birth control instead of insisting it be paid for by our tax dollars, that's a war against women. By the way, President Obama personally called Sandra. He did not call the parents of Kate, as in Kate's Law, as in the woman who was murdered recently by an illegal immigrant who had been arrested several times before but was given shelter in the sanctuary city of San Francisco. I guess if a woman is actually killed, that's not a war against women, or more correctly put, if a woman's situation does not fit Obama's political agenda, it's not a war against women. And while we're on the subject, defending women apparently doesn't include baby women. If you speak against Planned Parenthood selling full-grown baby bodies to make profits off the parts, well, you aren't pro-baby, you're anti-woman. And if you support Carly Fiorina as president, you are still anti-woman. A conservative woman doesn't count. She's not a real woman. Catching on? They just keep making this stuff up as they go. There's only one way to prove that you are not on a war against women. You must get behind a pathological liar who lied about Benghazi and lied about her email server to cover up the Benghazi scandal. Doesn't matter. She's pro-choice. Well, pro-choice with abortion. She and her Democratic friends aren't really pro-choice about anything else, are they? They certainly don't believe in school choice because they fight against vouchers, even though our beloved President Obama sends his own kids to a private school. Neither do they want you to choose your own radio shows, cars, cigars, unhealthy food, healthcare providers, amount of energy to use in the home, salaries to pay employees, location for religious assembly, location for religious symbols, and the amount of money to leave your children in a will, as opposed to giving half to the government. But a woman's right to choose an abortion? Go for it. Knock yourself out, kid. And yet, even here, there isn't much of a choice if our tax dollars, against our will, are funding a cesspool like Planned Parenthood, founded by the racist eugenicist Margaret Sanger, who believed in superior breeding and published an article by Adolf Hitler's eugenicist. Never mind all that. Get in step and march with our cause, or you are on a war against women. The only thing more pathetic than this idiotic strategy is that it will probably work. Ironically, they are assuming that people will vote for Hillary only because she's a woman, which means they are assuming that people will not think. What an insult. What contempt they have to their own constituency. What an insult to women if they assume that women will ignore the issues and get behind Madam Hillary simply because of gender. The very people they claim to defend are the people they are insulting. You're listening to The Bob Siegel Show.
Believe it or not, Bob Siegel is aware that there may be one or two people who disagree with his opinions. To offer your own comments on the topic at hand, or to challenge Bob with a thought-provoking question, feel free to contact Bob on Facebook, Twitter, or questions at bobsiegel.net.
When you trust the care of your children to others, it's comforting to know they share the same Christian values, that what you teach your children at home is also taught in their preschool environment. Wisdom Works Christian Preschool is an all-inclusive preschool where the staff ministers to all children of all abilities, including children with special needs, through a curriculum developed by the owners and designed for the preschool-age child 3 to 5. During these preschool years, your children will make important developmental gains, as well as social and emotional development, that'll be the foundation for their overall success in life. Wisdom Works Christian Preschool is a state-licensed, Bible-believing, Bible-teaching preschool and a nonprofit 501c3 organization. Contact us now at wisdomworkschristianpreschool.com and secure a space for your preschooler. wisdomworkschristianpreschool.com or call 619-440-1044. 619-440-1044. Wisdom Works Christian Preschool.
Back to 1170, The Answer. This is Bob Siegel who takes the question. Maybe I should change the name of my show. Instead of The Bob Siegel Show, The Question. Hear The Question every Sunday on The Answer. Nah, The Bob Siegel Show. What possible title could be better than a show than naming it after yourself? What a testimony to humility. Okay. Anyway, if you would like to send questions, though, because the part that I was telling you that was true is that I really do take questions. In fact, I thrive on questions. I love a plethora of questions. You can reach me on the internet, questions@bobsiegel.net. That's questions@bobsiegel, SIEGEL.net. And just to prove that I've stepped into the 21st century with everybody else, you can get me on Facebook. You can get me on Twitter, all that social media jazz. I'm right there in the heart of it. This is from a fellow named James. He says, "Hello, Bob. I recently listened to your debate with Mark Thomas on your website regarding whether or not the Christian God exists. I have now, I should tell you, Mark Thomas, that's an atheist I debated quite a few years ago. I do debates on the radio show, but this was one that was done before a live audience. The good thing, though, is that however long ago it was, it's found a happy home on my website, so you can go and listen to that at any time. So, listen to your debate with Mark Thomas on your website regarding whether the Christian God exists. I have some questions I would like to ask about this subject that I feel were not covered enough in the debate." Now, actually, he's asking things that were covered in the debate, but I understand. You hear two people talking, things go by, and perhaps it's been a long time since I've listened. Perhaps some of them could warrant more detail when you have a timed opening statement. You do tend to talk a mile a minute. So I do understand, James. We'll see if we can slow it down and do more detail for you here. And he says, "Before each question, I will write a little commentary just to show you where I am regarding the question." He says, "Virtually all scholars have come to the conclusion that Jesus did exist and believe he was executed. However, what evidence is there to suggest that Jesus rose from the dead? This is an extraordinary claim to make, and for this to happen, we would need what humans see as the supernatural to occur. I have never seen a supernatural event occur, so why should I believe that one occurred over 2,000 years ago when it appears we don't have enough evidence to suggest it does?" Well, James, thank you. It's a very good question. Actually, there's all kinds of evidence, even in the present, for miracles. I was one of several contributing writers to a book called Miracles Are For Real. The primary writer was Jim Garlow. And you can get that off of Amazon.com with all kinds of stories of miracles. And even there's even a story there that took place on this radio show where I interviewed a rock star named Casper McLeod, who had dropped dead in a church service. His own doctor was with him, verified he was dead, and was brought back to life. Miracles do happen. You're just not going to read about it in the New York Times, James. So, but let's go back to the time of Jesus. And I want to go back to what you said, because you mentioned that it's an extraordinary claim. Now, I've heard that phrase, extraordinary claim, from a lot of people. And usually when I'm talking to an atheist, and I'm not assuming that you are, James, you sound like a seeker. If I had to make a guess, I'd say you're probably an agnostic, or perhaps you believe in some kind of God already. You're just not sure it's the God of the Bible. But when I talk to actual diehard atheists, they also use this phrase, extraordinary claims. And there's a statement that you didn't exactly complete yourself. Perhaps it was on your mind, but I do hear this all the time. And the way it goes is like this. Extraordinary claims need extraordinary evidence. Whenever I speak of the historical validity of the resurrection, whenever I point out that if the same amount of eyewitnesses and historians who claim Jesus rose from the dead merely claimed that a man named Jesus gave a speech, or merely claimed that a man named Jesus started a revolution, nobody would doubt it. And I point that out, they smile and they go, well, but extraordinary claims need extraordinary evidence. Doesn't matter that you had some testimony. Doesn't matter that some people verified it. You need more. Now, I tend to resist that phrase. To me, either we have the evidence or we don't. It is either good evidence or it isn't. Our process for examining historical evidence must be objective. If we're going to begin with the bias that miracles are impossible, then no amount of evidence will ever be enough. Now, if you listen to that debate, you did hear me go through some definitions. And I think later on, when I get into another part of your question, you even acknowledge a little bit about my definition for evidence. Evidence is that which points to a high probability that something is true. Proof is something that goes through our senses and we witness. In history, it's impossible to have proof unless they invent a time machine. So we're doing this on the basis of evidence. Now, it's interesting that you did mention that historians, most of them, you are correct, most historians will acknowledge that Jesus lived and that he was executed. We can go even beyond that. We have historical verification that not only was Jesus executed, but that he was buried in a very unique way because of the political times with the Jewish puppet court Sanhedrin living under the Romans and the Jewish puppeteers. They had wanted Jesus executed, but they had to get permission from the Romans. Anyway, Pontius Pilate, the Roman governor of Judea, was confronted by some of the people who had put political pressure on him to order the execution of Jesus. And they said, this guy Jesus claims he's going to rise from the dead 3 days later. Now, we know, yuck, yuck, that that couldn't happen. But what if his disciples stole the body? So it's not just true that under Pilate we know Jesus died. We also know that under Pilate, the body of Jesus was put in what was called a sepulcher, like a hollowed cave with a boulder rolled in front of it. And some Roman guards were put on watch. Now, a Roman guard that watched something through the night, it was at least six, and then they slept in shifts. So at the very least, there were 12, six asleep, six awake. And we know Jesus was executed. We know he was buried in a sepulcher. We know he was guarded by Romans. We know that 3 days later, the body was missing. And the Roman soldiers claimed that they saw the tomb rolled away. In fact, that their claim was that they saw something like an angel roll away the boulder. And they went and spread this story that his disciples had come by night and stole him. Now, if we want to just use a deductive process here, the Roman soldiers are in charge of the whole world. They're in charge of the whole world. If you know how to run Western civilization, you have enough on the ball to guard one dead body. So the Pharisees, the religious leaders that wanted Jesus dead, they spread this story that the disciples of Jesus came by night and stole the body. Well, how did they get by the Roman soldiers to do that? And why were Jesus' disciples, who were such cowardly Kurds who fled and left him while he was alive, where did they suddenly get the nerve and the courage to risk their lives for his dead body? They couldn't find the courage to stick up for him while he's alive, but they're gonna rest their nerves and their courage, and they're going to stake their lives on his dead body. That doesn't make any sense at all. And if the Roman soldiers saw the disciples, then why didn't they stop them? If they didn't steal them, as the story went, they came by night while we slept. If they were asleep, how did they know it was the disciples? If they were awake, why didn't they stop? It just doesn't wash that the Roman soldiers would have had anything to do with it. And then some people say, well, maybe the Jewish religious leaders, the ones that wanted that, maybe they stole the body. Well, when Christianity, the movement of Christianity broke out, it divided Judaism. It divided Israel. The religious rulers did not like hearing Christians, Jewish people that had now become Christians, go out into the streets claiming Christ rose from the dead. They didn't like that. If they had the body of Jesus, they could have stopped Christianity dead in its tracks. He's not dead. Here's the body. See, Jesus, everybody knew what Jesus looked like. He had been executed on the Passover. That was when Jews came from all over the world. Jesus was the biggest thing in town for 3 years. They knew what Jesus looked like. The only reason they didn't stop this movement that they wanted to stop by showing the body of Jesus is they simply didn't have it. And there's only one other possibility. If we know, like, again, let's add this up. And you've said some of this yourself. Historically, we know he was executed. Historically, we know he was buried in a sepulcher, wrapped up like a mummy, a cloth, with soldiers guarding the tomb and a boulder in the way. And 3 days later, the boulder's rolled away. The body's gone. What are the only possibilities of what could have happened to the body if it didn't resurrect from the dead? One is that the Roman soldiers took it. We've dismissed that. One is that the disciples stole it. We've dismissed that. The only other possibility is that Jesus didn't actually die. Now, this has been actually entertained. There was a best-selling novel way back in the 60s called The Passover Plot, and they advanced what was called the swoon theory, where Jesus took a Romeo and Juliet type of drug that simulated death. Now, they did have a kind of drug that could simulate death in those days. Jesus was trying to play a trick on people. You see, he looked like he was dead, but he wasn't really dead. And then he snuck out and he was having a beer and laughing about it. Okay, look, he still got crucified. Could you survive a crucifixion? It was possible, very rare, but you would only live a few days. You're not in the best of shape when you're nailed to a cross, your hands and your feet. You're not in the best of shape. So catch this. Jesus is drugged. He looks like he's dead. Now, even if you put aside the biblical account, which says that a soldier thrust a spear in his side to make sure he was dead, even if you put that aside, I want you to imagine this now, the swoon theory in action. Jesus gets up after having been crucified, single-handedly unravels his cloth, single-handedly pushes aside a boulder, and then, mind you, single-handedly fights off at least 6, maybe 12 Roman soldiers. Folks, if he could have done all that, he might as well have just risen from the dead. That would have been every bit as much of a miracle. Bob Siegel. They say a man's home is his castle. So when it comes to the wiring of your house, you don't want to mess around with some unknown electrician. Instead, do what I did. Call W&S Electric Incorporated. W&S specializes in both contracting and repair. From troubleshooting to remodeling to circuit breakers and fuses, W&S takes a skilled but personal interest in your home at affordable rates. I know the owner, Wayne Klingenhofer, personally, and I can testify firsthand to his integrity. Call 619-447-8785. That's 447-8785 for W&S Electric Incorporated. License number 480-539. W&S Electric.
Hi, I'm Dana Wright, here to talk about Bob Siegel's book, I'd Like to Believe in Jesus, But... The title itself is an open-ended question. You fill in the rest. I'd like to believe in Jesus, but... Is there really proof for the resurrection of Christ? How could a loving God send people to hell? How will God judge people who never heard of Jesus? Can a scientific mind really accept miracles? These are but some of the concerns keeping honest seekers from considering Christianity. In an interesting, down-to-earth style, Bob tackles the hardest, most painfully honest questions. Rather than shoving these topics under the rug, Bob shows respect for his readers by providing detailed and compelling explanations. This book has been enjoyed by both skeptics and Christians alike. I'd Like to Believe in Jesus, But by Bob Siegel. Available on Amazon.com and BarnesandNoble.com.
Is there evidence that Jesus rose from the dead historically? There's as much evidence for that as anything else we accept through ancient history, and a good deal more evidence than what we accept in a lot of history since then. Fact, Jesus Christ's historical fact, as we define historical facts, Jesus Christ was executed, buried in a sepulcher, a cave with a boulder rolled in front of it, guarded by at least six Roman soldiers. Those Roman soldiers, it would have been, I didn't mention this before the break, it was against the law, under the Roman law, to break a burial ground, especially if it had a Roman seal on it. A Roman seal was marked by the governor. Anybody that broke that seal, they're going to be executed, and the Romans are going to risk their lives for some Jewish religion that they don't even believe in. The Jews, to them, were the scum of the earth. You got sent to Israel if you were a bad boy in the Roman army. That was like what was being banished to Siberia in those days. They didn't give a hang about Jesus, who he was, whether he rose from the dead, didn't rise from the dead. They're just not going to do it. We've already shown that the disciples could not possibly have done it. Jesus could not have faked his death and gone out. What's the remaining choice standing behind the curtain next to Carol Merrill? Well, he actually rose from the dead. Now, here's another thing I hear, though. If Jesus really rose from the dead, then somebody other than a Christian should have reported it. Well, usually once somebody knew Christ rose from the dead, they'd become a Christian. But having said that, there was a historian named Josephus. He was born very shortly after Jesus died and resurrected, but just died, if you will, for those of you that don't accept the resurrection yet. Hang on, yet. Josephus was a contemporary with the apostles. He was a Jewish historian. We know for a fact that he was not a Christian. He does refer to Jesus as the Christ, but you need to understand Jesus was a very common name in those days. In Hispanic cultures, it's still common today. But in a lot of cultures today, when you hear the word Jesus, you only think of Jesus of Nazareth. There were 14 different Jesuses spoken about by the ancient historian Josephus. So by calling him the Christ, he's just telling us which Jesus he's talking about. In his comprehensive report on the reign of Pontius Pilate, and that's what he was more interested in talking about, just to be thorough, he does include a paragraph about Jesus. And he says, and I'm reading from him, "Now there was about this time Jesus, a wise man, if it be lawful to call him a man, for he was a doer of wonderful works, a teacher of such men as receive the truth with pleasure. He drew over to him both many of the Jews and many of the Gentiles. He was the Christ. And when Pilate, at the suggestion of the principal men amongst us, had condemned him to the cross, those that loved him at the first did not forsake him, for he appeared to them alive again at the third day, as the divine prophets had foretold these and 10,000 other wonderful things concerning him. And the tribe of Christians so named from him are not extinct at this day." Now, many people try to discredit this, and they try to claim that Josephus didn't write it, but it's there. It's in the collected works of Josephus, the extant manuscript, archaeological tradition. It has it. It's there, right where it belongs, right where you would expect it. There's another passage from Josephus where he talks about James, the brother of Jesus, being executed. And there he refers to Jesus as the so-called Christ, meaning so-called that he himself doesn't number himself as a Christian. So here's somebody who wasn't a Christian, and yet there was so much testimony and evidence from people who had seen him rise from the dead that Josephus, who was Jewish and didn't have trouble believing in miracles but was not a Christian, nevertheless reported that Jesus had risen from the dead. There's another one that's very interesting and seldom talked about. Usually when I debate atheists, they have not heard of this one. Well, they're hearing about it now because they're getting smart enough to listen to the Bob Siegel Show. But usually when I debate them, they have not heard of this one. It's from the Talmud. Now, the Talmud was a collection of literature, oral at the time of Jesus, eventually reduced to writing. It includes a commentary of many parts of the Bible, particularly the first five books. And they had other things such as the Midrash that commented on other events. But they also commented on some of the history of their days in the Talmud. And in one book called the Sanhedrin, named for that puppet Jewish court, which I referred to before, Tractate 43a, they called Jesus a sorcerer and an apostate. Now, an apostate was somebody who deviated from the faith. The reason they called Jesus an apostate is Jesus claimed to actually be God. incarnate. Not that the Bible's claiming that God is a man. They're claiming that God took on the form and likeness of a man. But boy, for a Jew to claim that he's the God of Israel, the one and only true God of the universe, that is the most outrageous, heretical, apostate claim one could possibly make, unless he happens to be telling the truth. They didn't believe Jesus was telling the truth. So, of course, if he claims to be God, they're going to want to execute him. Now, they couldn't execute him themselves. They had to turn him over to the Romans. But they take credit for the execution because religiously they felt they were obeying the law of Moses to put to death any heretic. So it's understandable why they would call Jesus an apostate if Jesus is claiming to be God, but he wasn't really God and they didn't believe he was God, then that would make him heretic of heretics, apostate first class. But I am intrigued that they also called Jesus a sorcerer. Why? Because in those days, if you didn't like somebody and you didn't believe he was of God, but you could not deny the fact that he was doing miracles, and here we're bringing miracles into it again, James, we're specifically answering your question, why should you believe in miracles? Because even the enemies of Jesus authenticated that he did miracles. Now, Christians wouldn't like this passage because they're saying all these derogatory things about Jesus. They say, well, Jesus' disciples are going to write good things about him because they're biased. They like him. Sure, they were biased. Sure, they liked him. Here's a bias predisposed against Jesus by people who did not want to believe in him. So why admit that somebody did miracles if you didn't believe him? Because the testimony of the miracles was overwhelming. They could not deny that they took place. But they said, well, Satan can do miracles too. Remember when Moses went into Pharaoh's court and did a trick and took his staff and turned it into a snake? Pharaoh's magicians did the same thing, and the Jews believed that was by what they called black magic, the works of Satan, the enemy of God, a spiritual being who tries to camouflage and counterfeit the works of God. So they're saying, sure, Jesus did miracles, but he didn't by the power of Satan. Okay, and that's not a nice thing to say about Jesus. And theologically, Christians might hate that passage, but historically, it's an incredibly valuable passage because it testifies that Jesus did live and he did miracles. And we're getting the testimony from the enemies of Jesus. So his friends and enemies are saying the same thing. You could not possibly have better corroborative evidence. Now, there was another document called the Acts of Pilate. This was a report that Pilate himself wrote about the trial, and having been convinced himself by the miracles, actually converted to Christianity, sent it to the Roman Emperor Tiberius. Tiberius found it so overwhelming, but still didn't completely understand, that Tiberius asked the Roman Senate to classify Jesus as a god. They didn't do it. But boy, that's pretty good evidence if even Emperor Tiberius wants to classify Jesus as a god. For a church that will not only challenge you but help you to feel like a part of a family? Why not try Skyline Church, located in Rancho San Diego near 94 in Hamishaw? I can testify firsthand to Skyline because I myself am a member. When you visit, tell them Bob Siegel sent you and ask about that free week-long trip to Bermuda for first-time visitors. They'll look at you like they don't know what you're talking about, and you will not in fact get any free trip to Bermuda. But you'll still be glad for a chance to experience Skyline Church. You don't want to go to Bermuda anyway. Too hot. And people who approach that area have been known to disappear. But they don't disappear at Skyline. Those who visit usually can't wait to come back. Skyline Church, Sunday morning services at 8:30 a.m. and 10:30 a.m. the Bob Siegel Show. I was talking about a document called The Acts of Pilate, where Pilate, overwhelmed by the miracles and resurrection of Christ, announces his own conversion, sends it in a letter to Emperor Tiberius. Now, the bad news is that document does not exist anymore. It was either destroyed or it's lost and maybe waiting to be rediscovered like the Dead Sea Scrolls. What does exist, though, and we put history together all the time, is four different documents that refer to it. And I'm going to mention a couple of those. One of them is Justin Martyr, who referred to that document specifically, even by name. Now, we're talking about a letter that Justin Martyr wrote to the Roman Emperor Antoninus Pius in the year AD 150. Justin Martyr was one of the first people to be called a Christian apologist. I'm called a Christian apologist. That comes from the Greek word apologia, which meant an answer. They were people that gave rational reasons to become Christians, and also who defended Christianity against moral attacks. Did you know that in ancient Rome, there were all kinds of moral attacks levied against Christians? They were accused of being traitors to the Roman Empire. Actually, the Christians were very loyal to the Roman Empire, but some of them wouldn't serve in the army because in the army, you had to light incense to Caesar. And speaking of lighting incense to Caesar, different Roman emperors had different opinions about it. Most, or at least many, I would say, of the Roman emperors were kind of embarrassed by the idea of people calling them a god. They were very aware that they were not a god, but it was a good way to unify the country. You see, the Romans had conquered so many different people with so many different religions that they didn't really want to outlaw religion. They really had no compelling desire to outlaw Christianity. A few of them did. Most of them didn't, but they did say, look, you want to believe in Jesus? Believe in Jesus. All we ask is that you be open-minded enough to accept other religions, other paths to gods. That sound familiar? See, we think we're so brilliant in the 21st century. We think we're the ones that came up with all this idea like syncretistic religion and things like that. No, the Roman emperor said, you can believe in Jesus all you want, but you also have to call Caesar. You know, Julius Caesar's name had now become the nickname for all emperors. So here's Antoninus Pius, and the Christians are now being accused of being enemies of Rome. Another one that I loved is the Christians were accused of being atheists because they wouldn't call Caesar God. They were being called atheists. You got to see the irony when Christians are being executed for being atheists. And because some Christians, when they took communion, believed that the bread and the wine literally, miraculously changed into the body and blood of Jesus. Well, that's a belief I do not share. I believe that was just a symbol. I believe in miracles, as I've made very clear. I don't believe, though, that at the Last Supper, Jesus, when he broke the bread and ate it, said, this is my body, eat and remember me. I don't believe Jesus was eating his own body. So, okay, I know with God all things are possible, but I also believe, as C.S. Lewis would have said, another Christian apologist, nonsense is still nonsense, even when we're talking about God. But the early church, and there's churches today, that believe this, to them it's not nonsense. I respect that. In those days, some of them thought they were really eating the body and blood of Jesus when they took communion. So you know what the Romans accused them of? Cannibalism. So, boy, yeah, watch your theology. Your theology can come back to bite you on the butt. Anyway, so now we have a Christian apologist, one who defends Christianity academically. He's saying it's true, it's real, Jesus existed, he resurrected, these miracles are true, and he's also defending them morally. Dear Emperor, we're not a threat to you. And he refers to the Acts of Pilate. I told you the Acts of Pilate has been lost, but the works of Justin Martyr have not been lost. You can go to a bookstore, you can buy the translation, you can read it. In fact, I have a copy sitting on my very shelf in my personal library. Justin Martyr, an early Christian apologist, made clear reference to this document called the Acts of Pilate in a letter addressed to the Roman Emperor Antoninus Pius, AD 150, describing in detail the passion of Jesus. And he writes, and I'm quoting him, "And the expression 'they pierced my hands and feet' was used in reference to the nails of the cross which were fixed in his hands and feet, and after he was crucified, they cast lots upon his vesture, and they that crucified him parted it amongst them, and that these things did happen, you can ascertain from the Acts of Pilate." But then he goes on, I know he didn't say anything about miracles there, hold on to your seat, Justin then went on to list many of Jesus's miracles, such as the healing of the blind and the lepers. He also credits Jesus with raising people from the dead. This description of Jesus's deeds is concluded with the following words, and that he did those things you can learn from the Acts of Pilate. Now, there was another Christian apologist named Tertullian that talked in even more detail about the Acts of Pilate. And there he mentions the soldiers guarding the tomb and the boulder being rolled away and all those Steven Spielberg special effects. Now, Tacitus was an ancient historian. Anybody that studies ancient Rome, they read the works of Tacitus. Tacitus and Suetonius are two of the best historians Rome ever had. He lived about AD 56 to 117 approximately. So as you can see, he's not living long after the time of Christ. And he was writing about the great fire of Rome. Now, some people believe Emperor Nero started that fire. Whether he did or not is not absolutely certain. What we did know is he blamed it on Christians. Now, Tacitus did not have any great respect for Christians himself. He thought he certainly didn't believe they should be getting blamed or getting executed. But he didn't seem to believe in it. Even in those days, you had intellectuals who thought that believing in something like the supernatural was just superstition. In fact, he called Christianity a superstition. But by calling it a superstition, he's at least admitting that they're claiming the supernatural. We have a piece of papyri that has survived where a letter is written to him talking about the great reputation he has. He simply would not have talked about Christianity and Jesus without investigating it. And since he lived in Rome, he would have had access to the imperial archives. So what would he have had access to? The Acts of Pilate, which had been sent to Emperor Tiberius along with his report. And so he would have had access to that. And here's what he says about Christianity. Their originator, Christ, here we have somebody else who's not a Christian, but refers to him as Christ because that was the nickname he developed. Their originator, Christ, had been executed in Tiberius's reign by the governor of Judea, Pontius Pilate, but in spite of this temporary setback, the deadly superstition had broken out afresh, not only in Judea where the mischief had started, but even in Rome, all degraded and shameful practices collect and flourish in the capital. By the way, this is kind of a side note, but there's something else we can learn from Tacitus here. Notice that he refers to this area known as Judea. The word Jew is short for Judah or Judea. He's saying that Jews lived in that land. There's a bunch of historical spin and historical revision which claims that there was this indigenous group of people known as the Palestinians that lived in that land for hundreds of years until the 1900s where the Jews came over from Europe and kicked them out, and that the Jews' ancestry is European. All pure poppycock, according to the ancient historian Tacitus, who had no love for Christianity or Israel, but is he admitting that the people that are living in Judea are Jews? But anyway, back to Christ. Okay, he's calling the belief in Christ a superstition. He's saying that the execution of Christ stopped the superstition, but it broke out afresh. If the execution of Christ stops the superstition, what must he be referring to when he says it broke out afresh? He's referring to the resurrection, something he personally doesn't believe, but something that he's acknowledging was reported and spread so persuasively that it didn't stop in Judea. It made its way all the way to Rome, and Rome was not around the corner.
If you enjoy listening to The Bob Siegel Show, check out his online column, Forbidden Table Talk, published and hosted weekly by Communities Digital News. Bob is also a regular contributor to San Diego Rostra. We invite you to visit Bob's website at www.bobsiegel.net. You can listen to previous radio shows, read Bob's many articles about Christianity, and find information about Bob's books. That's www.bobsiegel.net. Bobsiegel.net.
some questions from one of my listeners named James. Now, James, I know you wanted a lot of detail about historical sources for Jesus. I did not give you all of them, but I want to tell you how you can get more detail. I actually did two whole radio shows 2 weeks in a row on this back in the year 2014. If you go to my website and go into the radio section, the show dated 9/14/14, the title of the show is called Ancient Records of Jesus Outside the New Testament. And then just look at the following week and you'll have the second half of that. You'll have a lot more detail. There's also detail in my book, I'd Like to Believe in Jesus, But I'm Not Here to Sell You the Book. Tell you what, James, if you want to send me your snail mail address by email, I would be happy to send you a complimentary copy of that book. And for those of you listening and you're getting real excited, you go ahead and send me your address too, and I'll tell you how you can buy my book. Maybe I'll give out another free copy. Who knows? You can get it on Amazon.com either way or BarnesandNoble.com. Anyway, James went on to ask some other questions. So now we're going to shift gears. According to the book of Genesis, the first two humans created were Adam and Eve, and they were in the Garden of Eden. However, there is universal agreement that the first humans were from Africa. Well, the first evidence of advanced human civilization, James, comes from an area that was known as Mesopotamia. It's roughly where we would call Iran, Iraq today. But anyway, he goes on, universe agreement that the first humans were from Africa and that we evolved. He says, I won't go into evolution. I assume you accept it, as virtually all leading scientists have, as indisputable fact. So based on that and the lack of detail on the creation of the universe in Genesis, why should I believe that the book of Genesis is the explanation of the creation of the universe and of man? Well, it's true, James, that Genesis doesn't give a lot of detail about creation. It simply says in the beginning God instead of in the beginning hydrogen. But the lack of detail doesn't mean that what it's saying is not true. However, James, you assume incorrectly when you suggest that I accept evolution, and it's not true that evolution is indisputable fact. There are people that have claimed evidence for evolution. We could evaluate the evidence, but remember, evolution has never been proven. Nothing in science is proven unless it's repeatable and observable. Now, microevolution, changes within the same species, that can be observed. Different kinds of cats, different kinds of canids. But macroevolution, changes from one species to another, are not being observed. Neither would an evolutionist make such a claim, since in his opinion, it would take millions of years for it to morph from one species into another. What frequently happens is people talk about macroevolution, and then as evidence, they give you examples, and there's abundant examples of micro. But changes within species and macroevolution are very, very different. You see, James, evolution does not merely teach that man came from ape-like creatures. They don't even say apes anymore. They say ape-like creatures. Evolution teaches that all species were once related. Birds, reptiles, mammals, fish, all related. If this is really true, we should find literally billions upon billions of missing link fossils. And knowing that we don't even come remotely close, evolutionists will still point to a handful of alleged fossils, very disputed even amongst evolutionists, but they claim to these few scanty findings as clear, abundant evidence for macroevolution. At this point, I have to make a simple observation. To my atheist friends who always tell me extraordinary claims need extraordinary evidence, my friend, claiming that all species were once related is an extraordinary claim. What happened to the extraordinary evidence? We don't have it from evolution. And then James asks another question, perhaps the most important that he's asking. He says, I have heard you say before that you have experienced God. Unfortunately, I have not had such a pleasure, nor do I know anyone who has. I have relatives who have been church-going Christians all their lives and have not experienced God. Unfortunately, that's very true. Sometimes the last place to find God is in a church. When I did have my experience with God, coming out of a Jewish family and an atheist family, I should say, when I went back to my Christian friends that grew up in the church, they didn't know what I was talking about when I said I experienced God. So it's not uncommon to find people that say they haven't experienced God who nevertheless call themselves Christians. So James says, in what way have you experienced God? How do you know that the experience was genuine and not the product of your imagination? As far as we know, the brain gives you all your thoughts, and therefore any experience you may have is a product of the brain. That's true, James, but you can say that about anything. When you're talking to your girlfriend, when you're talking to your best friend, when you're driving your car, any experience that goes through your senses goes through the brain. If you want, you could doubt anything. You could say, maybe I'm a horsefly dreaming that he's a human, but I don't think you go your life that way. We have to assume, we have to stipulate the validity of the senses. In fact, the moment, James, you say, show me evidence for the resurrection, I assume you're going to use your senses to acknowledge the resurrection. So how do I know that what I claim I sensed, that my senses were in tune with God, how do I know it isn't just my brain the same way I know anything else? We have to trust the brain. And then finally, James says, how can I experience God? I have tried through prayer, as have many people I know, with no success. Well, James, I ask you to continue with that. My heart goes out to you, my friend. I can see that you sincerely are seeking God. The Bible says God is a rewarder of those who diligently seek him. Now, what kind of experience am I talking about? It's found in the Bible, 1 John 4:13, very important verse. This is how we know, not believe, not faith. The Bible doesn't talk about blind faith. Faith to the men who wrote the Bible meant obeying God. They weren't asking people to follow something that wasn't true. They were assuming they could have a relationship with God. And what did that mean? John tells us very clearly, John, the apostle John, who was the disciple John, one of the 12 disciples that followed Jesus around for 3 years, he says, this is how we know that we live in him and he in us. He has given us his spirit. The Bible lists a variety of methods through which God communicates. He can speak audibly. He can also use dreams and visions. He can send prophets or angels. But his primary method of communication today is communication from his Holy Spirit. James, I used to say to myself, wouldn't it have been wonderful to be one of Jesus' original 12 disciples, to be able to follow him around and listen to him teach for 3 years? Well, believe it or not, Jesus told his disciples that this was not ideal. After he left the world and after the Holy Spirit came to take his place, they would be experiencing a much better and closer relationship with God. God's Spirit would indwell them, and the same Spirit would run his thoughts through their minds. Admittedly, this is not as flashy as lightning-type special effects. In fact, it is so subtle and personal, we often take it for granted. We can get used to the gentle voice of God to the point where it is only a dull murmur in the background to be ignored. But this is just exactly what God offers to you, a relationship with his Spirit. Now, when I first experienced this, I was very aware that the supernatural entity was making contact with me. It was this very loving feeling, but I knew that it was alive. I have also had the experience of hearing audible voices. That doesn't mean that everybody has to, but primarily we're talking about God running his thoughts through your thoughts. And then when you wonder if a thought is coming from God, you can ask him, and then you will feel his presence. And it's like a bubbling fountain or a geyser just welling up inside of you. It's something that is so difficult to put into the words that you're just going to have to experience it for yourself. But that is what the Bible means when they talk about the presence of the Lord or the Holy Spirit. Sometimes the Bible also uses the phrase, the peace of God, which passes all understanding. So even though I'm talking as one who's already experienced it, my friend, this experience is waiting for you. I don't know why it's not coming as quickly. Sometimes there's things in our life God wants us to deal with. Of course, the bottom line is that somebody goes to God and offers to turn from their sin, which the Bible defines as selfishness. Now, if you went to God and said, God, I'm not even sure you exist, or I believe you exist, but I'm not sure you're the God of the Bible, I'm not sure you're Jesus, but I'm going to ask you to come into my heart. Lord, if you do make yourself known, I promise to obey you. Imagine that there's a door in front of you. Jesus may or may not be on the other side of the door. If you open the door and Jesus is there, will you serve him? If God knows that you will, he will eventually make himself known to you. I hope this helps. Please feel free to write me if you have any more questions. And that goes for everybody else. Feel free to write the question, because I'll be dealing with it on The Answer.
The Bob Siegel Show on AM 1170. The Answer is sponsored by Bob Siegel.